Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The oil boom is on in McKenzie County, North Dakota. More than 4,000 wells have been drilled since 2008, and the county expects they'll be pumping for decades. A 2013 report by the Local Development Corporation predicts more than 8,600 wells by 2025. These wells are part of the thriving domestic oil production that surpassed oil imports for the first time in two decades. Maybe you heard about that benchmark passed last fall, or maybe you've heard stories or seen pictures of the work camps popping up on the Dakota fields, along with the businesses launched to feed, clothe, and entertain workers. But what do they look like? Earlier this summer, journalist Tom Haynes, who also teaches journalism at UNH, went to find out for himself. He walked 65 miles through the heart of McKenzie County and met ranchers and farmers and geologists and oil workers. He tracked his trip on a blog called Fuel Walk, A Journey Across America's Energy Landscapes, and joins us now to fill us in with more. Tom, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
So what did you know about what McKenzie County looked like before this oil boom all started?
Very little. I mean, I had driven across North Dakota a few times, and I had worked in eastern North Dakota as a journalist. I knew it was plains. It's the part of the High Plains. This boom is in western North Dakota, which is has some of the badlands and is more rugged. The Missouri River cuts through the northwest corner. But, you know, I had images of prairie and farmland and I suppose oil wells.
What does it look like now?
All of that. I mean, it is depending on where you are and depending on how far you cast your gaze, you can see sort of snapshots of time. You can be standing and you can see the typical abandoned old farmhouse, wooden farmhouse with grass growing up through the roof, or you can see a wide open field full of canola or flaxseed. But if you were to rotate a few degrees in any direction, pretty soon you'd see either an oil well pumping away. These are wells that have been drilled over the last 5 or 6 years, or some actually there were smaller booms in the 50s and 80s. But you would also see dozens, if you were to look far and wide, of oil rigs drilling. So this is the Bakken oil boom drilling down into the Bakken shale formation to get oil and gas.
And this has happened so very quickly. I mean, that's my understanding of it, that it is actually like the Wild West. Did it feel like that for you?
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, I've reported all over the world, and I've never been any place quite like this as far as being in the center of a moment. You know, and this is the story of gold rushes and oil rushes throughout time, you know, that something is struck and people move in. But there's a confluence here. I mean, this is happening at modern time and modern technology, and we have global markets and incredible infrastructure of trucking and transportation to get things into a place quickly. The rush is on. So they've known this oil has been there for years, but it's never been economically viable. Oil prices are high enough that there are companies everywhere, ConocoPhillips, XTO, Whiting Oil, Continental Resources. They're everywhere. And North Dakota has a regulatory structure that encourages that. Mineral rights trump everything. So if an oil company can negotiate with a mineral rights holder to get oil, it's theirs.
Mm. You met a lot of people that you call internal migrants, refugees of sorts, mm-hmm. from other poor economies around the country who came looking for work. Can you give us some? I know you met a lot of them, but generally, how do they live? How many are there? What's their life like?
So you're right. I mean, it's striking, right? It's a real window into the broader U.S. economy to wander around and talk to people. I wasn't even keeping track, but it struck me about 6 or 7 days into it. I made a list of the states that I had met people from, and without even really asking everybody. And I was at 31, just sort of jotting them down, everywhere from Maine and New Hampshire to Florida to California, a lot of the Rocky Mountain West. And so first of all, what you hear over and over again of stories, people with quote-unquote normal lives back home, they had had a job, they had a mortgage, they had a house, and they lost it. Times got tough. And so they loaded up their truck and they headed out to North Dakota. I met a lot of those people in really sort of ad hoc camps where trailer parks would be set up and they would sign a lease for $650 a month to put their camper there, and they'd sign on for work, and they'd start working $25 an hour and see if they could make it all work.
How about for the ranchers and the farmers and the locals? How has the boom changed their economic, certainly, and social lives?
Yeah, so it depends. You know, that's the biggest impact I heard about from ranchers was sort of that social question, the kind of quality of life and sort of traditions, right? This is a very isolated place. It's one of the last places in the lower 48 states to get settled. It's a quiet place. And a lot of people talk about that loss of community. You know everybody. Having said that, it's been a very bad economy for decades. And I think a lot of ranchers I talked to were sort of straddling this kind of happy and sad divide between we need the jobs, we need the work, it's good to have something coming in and keeping this going, and yet it's changing our way of life. A second piece of that that's really important is in North Dakota, mineral rights and surface rights are not always connected. So it depends on who you are. If you're a rancher who keeps your mineral rights and an oil company comes along,
you can make a lot of money.
Millionaires. As one woman said who's from an old-time family, there are millionaires being made here every day, and it's true. If you're a rancher who maybe your grandfather or grandparents in the 1930s, before mineral rights were worth much, sold them to buy a tractor. They sold them to somebody in town. That person's left, and now there's a great niece in Los Angeles who has those mineral rights. And the oil company goes out and negotiates the lease with the niece in Los Angeles. She'll become a millionaire, and the farmer back home now has three oil rigs within 500 feet of his house. So it's really complicated. And what's interesting to me is it's just a real case study in the trade-offs we make in our rush to kind of feed our energy appetite.
We're getting a slice of America's new energy reality with Tom Haines, who's a journalist. He also teaches journalism at UNH. He trekked across the heart of McKenzie County, that's in North Dakota, which is one of the areas of the country that's been transformed by the domestic oil boom now going on in the U.S. So this young geologist you speak to, he says this isn't going away. There's money to be made. How did people react to you? What did they think when they saw you trekking along with your backpack? Suspicious?
So no, friendly? This was, it was the most fun I'd had in a long time, both journalistically and just personally in terms of like travel, because I would be walking down this, a 4-mile stretch of dirt road in the middle of the prairie, and a pickup truck would go by with two oil workers in it. And they'd slow down, and the first reaction was kind of, either they wouldn't stop because they almost couldn't believe that I was out there with my backpack, or if they slowed down, we'd talk, which happened all the time. There was this camaraderie. We were sort of in it together. They'd say, "What are you doing out here?" And I'd explain, "Oh, I'm writing, stories, and I'm out here writing about the oil patch, and I'm walking because I want to see life." And they'd kind of shake their head, and the next question they'd say is, "Well, do you have enough water? Or where are you going to sleep? Take care of yourself." There was a lot of this kind of what I imagined has always existed in these places. On the one hand, yeah, it's a hard life. There's a lot of bad stuff. And we can, I talked to people about crime increasing and all this stuff. But there's also a lot of sort of, for lack of a better term, like shared humanity, where people are kind of looking out for each other. And I think that people saw me coming down the road with my backpack and they think, he's out here too, just like us. So that was really just an incredible part of the trip.
Yet in Watford City, where you finally put down your pack, you meet somebody who says, there are drugs going on out here. There's activity. There's wildness. Just this kind of wildness.
Absolutely. And Watford City is interesting. It's the seat of McKenzie County. It's a town that, the statistics have almost become sort of common now. But a town like 6 years ago had 1,400 residents. So, very small town sitting on the high plains. Now they figure over 10,000. And I talked to some city people who said they are kind of working on the assumption there's 15,000 or 20,000 people around. They don't know because in these trailer camps. So with that has come everything. I've talked to the police chief in Watford City. There's drug trafficking is up. There are cartels that are bringing in drugs from big cities. There's prostitution. There's I talked to a domestic violence advocate. There's a lot of just sort of social problems and social challenges that have come with this press of people. And yet there's sort of as the minister said, a new normal emerging there. And they're kind of catching up to that. They're building a new high school. They're building a new hospital. They're building a new roundabout road. And there's kind of like the woman you mentioned in the campground where I stayed. It was a woman who said, people are waiting for civilization to catch up. And I feel like that's really what's happening.
Well, Tom, you've been back a couple weeks now, and somebody did ask you at the end of your trip, any big epiphanies, you know, and of course it takes time to think about those things, and I'm wondering about that. You know, do you think differently about getting in your car and driving? Do you think differently about using the energy that you and your family use now that you've seen at least one source?
Yes. I mean, I think if there's one thing, my general motivation in doing this, and I'm going to be doing some other trips along this line, was to go to the source and to kind of connect myself and hopefully through writing and telling the stories, connect readers and listeners to that too. And that is the overwhelming kind of sort of takeaway for me, is how intimate this process is. You know, our consumption of energy is completely unintimate. You know, we don't know where it comes from. You pump something out of a gas. Did it come from the Nigerian Delta? Did it come from the Middle East? Did it come from the Gulf of Mexico? We don't know, right? When we turn on our lights, is that fueled by coal or natural gas? Who knows? We're not really paying attention to this, and who has time? But in the end, the harvesting of every bit of fuel that powers our lives happens somewhere really specific, and it's harvested by someone very specific, you know, an individual who's working on the pump, and it's happening in the yard of a rancher or their family who, you know, they're standing out there waiting for the bus, and there's the oil rig, their well water, you know, all these different things. And so I think that's my takeaway, is just that in this era when it's so easy to feel that we're not connected, we are. You know, we're all connected to this, and so it ties back into bigger questions about where is it all going.
Journalist and UNH professor Tom Haines, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Haines walked 65 miles through the heart of North Dakota oil country and tracked his trip on a blog called Fuel Walk, a journey across America's energy landscapes. You'll find more at wordofmouthradio.org.